Hello and welcome to this podcast. My name is Jeff Riddle. I'm the pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this episode, I'm going to be reviewing a YouTube video in which there was a discussion of the Gospel of Mark, and in particular, a discussion of the ending of Mark. And so this video was posted to YouTube back on January the 14th of 2023. The YouTube video was titled Creating Jesus, the Gospel of Mark. And this appeared on the channel of a young woman named Emma Thorne. I'd never heard of her before. She's looks like a 20-something British young woman. She's a YouTuber, and just looking at her channel, she deals a lot with skepticism, especially about Christianity, of course, and atheism. And so in this episode, she had as her guest a fellow named James Tabor. And I wasn't really all that familiar with James Tabor, but he's a retired professor of biblical studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And he's got an interesting bio. He formerly was a member of the Herbert W. Armstrong Worldwide Church of God, and he taught as a graduate student at their Ambassador College. But then he sort of departed from that, what was really like a Christian cult, and went into mainstream academic study of religion. I think he did his PhD at the University of Chicago, and he'd been teaching for a long time at UNC Charlotte. I think was once the chairman of the religion department there. He's sort of like a Bart Ehrman. You know, Bart Ehrman sort of has the deconversion story. In this case, Tabor was part of a sort of a Christian cult. And sort of he also leads in being very skeptical towards Christianity, much like a Bart Ehrman. Interestingly enough, just looking at his Wikipedia page, it says he's also the chief editor of something called the Original Bible Project. And this is something that's apparently been going on for some years, but it's never really been published. It's called the TEV, the Transparent English Version. And so that's all we need is another translation of the Bible in English on the market. So apparently this one was supposed to be some sort of scholarly Bible. I'm sure it was based on a majorly reconstructed modern text. So anyways, I think in his retirement, though, Tabor is teaching some online courses, and it sounds like maybe Emma Thorne, the host, has been taking a class that he's been teaching, especially on the Gospel of Mark. Perhaps it's the same title as the YouTube video, Creating Jesus, the Gospel of Mark. What I'm interested in is the discussion that takes place in the midst of this video on the ending of Mark. And it's very interesting to listen to Tabor talk about his views on the ending of Mark because it sounds very familiar. It sounds like the view of most mainstream modern evangelical scholars. He holds some of the same views and reaches some pretty radical conclusions about it. So I'm not going to play the entire video. I'm just going to play maybe 5 or 6 minutes of it. So let me, if I can, pull up the video, see if we can get it up. And there we are. And this is Emma Thorne here on the left. And this is Dr. James Tabor. And they're going to have a discussion here at about the 9-minute and 10-second mark relating to the ending of the Gospel of Mark. So let's listen in, and I'll stop and make some comments as we proceed.
I think to be contrary and jump all the way to the end for a second, I'd like to get your opinion on this and understand how this sort of factors into your reading. The ending of Mark seems to end quite abruptly, sort of a shocking cliffhanger of a thing. Then there's this sort of...
Okay, so she's going to talk about the ending of Mark, and like a lot of postmodern type people, when you're sold the bill of goods that Mark ends abruptly at Mark 16:8 with, as it says, the women going out quickly and trembling and being amazed and not saying anything to anyone, for they were afraid. That's a dramatic, you know, avant-garde cliffhanger of an ending. But she's going to ask Tabor what his view is on the other endings that of course she assumes, and Tabor will reinforce her in thinking that the traditional ending is a spurious ending. So let's listen to her pose the question and to Dr. Tabor give his response.
Extension that you sometimes get to Mark 16, 9 to 20.
That's right.
Most versions of the Bibles come with a little, this version does not appear in the earliest, some of the earliest manuscripts.
Okay, isn't it interesting? This atheistic person notices that in the modern Bibles, it has this note explaining that the Mark 16, 9 through 20 supposedly doesn't appear in the, quote, earliest and best manuscripts, end quote. Is that a true assertion? She seems delighted in it.
I've seen this debated, but I understand the sort of general consensus among scholars, at least, is that Mark should sort of end at 16, 8. Can you tell us why that's the case? How this happens?
Well, there's actually three what I would call appended endings that were added later.
Okay, this is kind of interesting. This actually sounds a lot like James White. This is what James White said. There are many endings to the Gospel of Mark. So he says there were actually three appended endings to the Gospel of Mark. But anyone who actually looks at the evidence will find out that 99% of the extant Greek manuscripts of the Gospel of Mark include the traditional ending, Mark 16, 9 through 20. 99% of the extant Greek manuscripts, that includes some of the earliest uncial manuscripts that we have, including Codex Alexandrinus. And also, the traditional ending is cited in some of the early church fathers of the second century, including Justin Martyr, and also Irenaeus of Lyon. And he says there are three different endings. There is an ending that's called the so-called shorter ending. And now this verse is being printed in some modern, even evangelical Bibles, like the New Living Translation. But the so-called shorter ending, there's not a single Greek manuscript that ends at Mark 16, 8, and then has the so-called shorter ending. There are only two extant manuscripts that end at Mark 16, 8, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Only two early ones, and there's one much later one, but only two early ones, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, and 99% have Mark 16, 9 through 20 as the proper ending. Then, with this so-called shorter ending, there are no manuscripts that have like verse 8 and then the so-called shorter ending, and that's the end. Whenever the shorter ending appears, it only appears in six extant Greek manuscripts, it proceeds to have verses 9 through 20. So even the handful of manuscripts, literal handful, that include the shorter ending also include verses 9 through 20. And by the way, those six early, or not early, those six extant Greek manuscripts that have the so-called shorter ending, the earliest of those is from the 7th century, and the latest is from the 13th century. There are no early witnesses to the so-called shorter ending. It's clearly a much later addition in the scribal tradition. And then there's one manuscript, Codex W, that has an addition that's called the so-called Freer Logion, that appears after Mark 16, 14. Now, with that very meager evidence for anything but the traditional ending, Tabor's going to say, with authority, New Testament professor, there are at least three different endings. No, there really aren't. There's a really strong consensus that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is the traditional ending, and this was the consensus that's found throughout Christian history. But for people who are skeptical, they want to play up this so-called diversity of endings here. But let's let Tabor continue to discuss this.
It definitely ends at verse 8, as I understand it.
He says it definitely ends at verse 8, even though there are only two extant manuscripts, early manuscripts, that end in this way, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And despite the fact that it would be, as some have described it, described it a grammatical barbarity for the passage to end at verse 8, because it would end with the postpositive conjunction gar. And yet he can say definitively now that it ends at verse 8.
As we cover it in the course, that's obviously one of the big things we cover at the end. And I don't mind you skipping to the end, because the end is pretty dramatic in an anticlimactic way.
Yeah.
But the last view we get of Jesus is he's dead on the cross. This is the last scene of Jesus. And he's just said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that's all he says on the cross. That's another reason why you can't conflate these. Like, I think Jesus says seven things on the cross. Catholics know the seven sayings on the cross. Mark just has one. Well, it's pretty different to have seven versus one. And if that one is, God forsook me, and I'm wondering why. And
then All right, let's just pause here for a moment. So Tabor wants the Gospel of Mark to end at Mark 16:8. And here I think he makes it pretty clear why he wants that. He wants the story of Jesus to end with his crucifixion. And he wants it not only to end with the crucifixion of Jesus, he wants it to end with Jesus in despair and angst, uttering, as it's recorded in Mark 15 and verse 34, the so-called cry of dereliction, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? So that's where he wants it to end. That would be just great for him. Jesus is just a man. He dies in agony, in pain on the cross, and that's the end of the story. There's some problems, though, with this. I mean, the first major problem is that when Christ quotes from, when Christ says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He is quoting the Old Testament. And he is quoting from Psalm 22, which is a messianic psalm. And it does indeed begin in Psalm 22:1, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But very often in the New Testament, the writers are writing for audiences that know well the scriptures. Christ is speaking to disciples from the cross who knew well the scriptures. And often when there is a citation by Christ or by one of the apostles of a passage in the Old Testament, especially the Psalms, they expect that the hearers will know its context. And if you look at Psalm 22, although it begins with a cry of despair, it ends with hope, trust, and confidence in the Lord. And so if you look at the end of Psalm 22, you'll see that it ends in verse 28 and following, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he is the governor among the nations. All they that be fat upon earth shall eat and worship. All they that go down to the dust shall bow before him, and none can keep alive his own soul. A seed shall serve him. It shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. They shall come and declare his righteousness unto a people that shall be born that he hath done this. So it actually ends with confidence in the Lord's vindication of those who die faithfully. And of course, Christ dies faithfully. He's a perfect man without sin, and his death is unjust. And the Lord vindicates his life by raising him from the dead. The other thing I find interesting about this is he's trying to say that whereas there's a gospel tradition of seven sayings from the cross, Mark has only one. Well, the seven so-called sayings from the cross are drawn from the various gospels. No one of the gospels has seven sayings of Christ on the cross. Matthew also records Christ saying, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Luke records Christ saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And he also records Christ saying, into thy hands I commend my spirit. John has him saying, I thirst. John has him saying to his mother at the tomb, behold thy son. And then saying to John, behold thy mother. And so there's no one gospel with seven sayings. And so Tabor, you would think, who has a PhD in New Testament, has taught it for years, wouldn't want to confuse things. But here to get to his point, he wants to say it's odd that Mark only has Christ saying one thing on the cross and not seven. But there's no gospel that has seven sayings of Christ on the cross. Again, our main point here is he wants the story of Jesus to end with his death. That's why it's convenient for him to have the story of Jesus end at Mark 16:8. Let's continue.
He's dead. And then a Roman centurion says, surely this was the Son of God. That's the last we see. So then when you come to this tomb that is discovered by the women early Easter morning, as we call it today, there's no Jesus. He's just gone. And they're told they'll see him in the Galilee as he said, which is referring back to this transfiguration scene, I think, earlier in chapter 9 of Mark. And so the added endings that you mentioned, verses 9 through...
Again, the so-called added endings, plural. There aren't added endings. There's one predominant ending, and it's the traditional ending, Mark 16:9-20.
20, and actually there are two or three more, depending on...
Two or three more. Again, this is an exaggeration. 99% of the extant manuscripts have Mark's gospel reading as it does now in most of our printed Bibles, Mark 16:9-20.
The manuscripts that you go to. One way you can kind of reason backward with them, if you read that ending of 9 through 20, which is the most common one, it's in the King James Version, it's in all...
It was in the King James Version. I love the way these people, like a lot of evangelical scholars, by the way, they try to pin traditional readings, on the King James Version. And they've done such a job of trying to denigrate and criticize the King James Version. They think they win points with sophisticated people. They say, well, this is a reading in the King James Version. It's not just a reading in the King James Version. It's a reading in 99% of extant Greek manuscripts. It's a reading in all the ancient versions. It's supported by the predominant readings in the ancient versions. It's the traditional printed Greek text of the New Testament reading. It's the traditional Protestant translation of the Bible reading. It didn't start with the King James Version. It was there in Tyndale. It was there in the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible, the Geneva Bible. It was there in all the vernacular translations of the Bible into the various European languages, whether that be Hungarian, Dutch, French, Spanish, Italian. But he wants to give a subtle undermining of the authority of this by saying, oh, sophisticated people, this is a King James Version reading. And so it gets tiresome, but and it's funny how they so often do this. It's not a negative that it's part of the King James Version. It shows that it's part of the classic Protestant Bible translation based on the traditional text.
Conservative Bible translations. It's clearly been cobbled together where somebody's not happy with the ending of Mark being so sudden. The women fled from the tomb in trembling and fear and said nothing to anyone, period. And picture the play, the curtain goes down, and the audience is sitting there going, what? Like, what?
Don't you love the way she laughs at this? I mean, she thinks this is great sport to ridicule the ending of Mark. And how all those foolish people believe that it ends at Mark 16:20, but they have the real gnosis, and they know that it ends at Mark 16:8. And by the way, this idea that it ends suddenly, abruptly at 16:8, and this is like a drama, or he'll say in just a moment, it's like a movie. This is an anachronistic reading of the Gospel of Mark. They were not, the author of the Gospel of Mark was not, again, a beat poet. And the best book to read on this is one by a fellow named Croy, and it's called The Mutilation of Mark's Gospel, where he, I think, just completely destroys this sort of avant-garde attempt to read the supposed ending of Mark 16:8 as being like a film or like a piece of modern art.
He said nothing to anyone, and like it's one of those, you know, it's like a movie where you're in the theater and all of a sudden you go, it's over. We've all seen films like that. They're usually considered
it's like a good tragedy. Film. It's a tragic cliffhanger.
Yeah. You then have to figure it out. You have to figure it out.
This is exactly what I'll say this at the end. This is exactly what Dan Wallace says. That's why he thinks it's so compelling if it ends at Mark 16. You, the reader, you have to figure it out. You have to complete the story.
You're the one that has to deal with that. Well, obviously, that's not good for catechism. So you got to say, wait, and then he appeared, and then he did this, and then he did that, and he ate fish, and he was definitely it. And Mark,
of course, what he's dismissing is the fact that, yes, a traditional gospel will have the resurrection appearances of the Lord Jesus Christ. If Mark ends at Mark 16:8, it's unlike all the other canonical gospels. Matthew ends with the resurrection appearances of Christ. Luke ends with the resurrection appearances of Christ. John ends with the resurrection appearances of Christ. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 verses 3 and following says, rehearses his gospel preaching, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and the 12. The resurrection appearances are essential for a gospel. But he's going to say, no. Mark ended at 16:8, and then nervous Orthodox people cobbled together some sort of fake ending. He has no historical basis for this. It's a pure speculation on his part. It's completely unsupported by the evidence. Again, only two manuscripts, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And I should mention that both of them have scribal marks at the end that show that the scribes of those documents knew the ending and perhaps were attempting to suppress it for whatever reason.
It doesn't do any of that, because I don't even think Mark believes in any kind of bodily resurrection.
Did you hear that? He wants Mark to end of Mark 16:8 because he does not believe that Mark even believes in any kind of bodily resurrection. And now we're getting to the real heart of what motivates many secular scholars, unbelieving scholars like Dr. Tabor and others. They like the idea of a gospel that ends with the death of Jesus and doesn't include the resurrection. And he has a theory, more radical theory, that Mark doesn't even believe in the resurrection. Sometime back, I did a podcast, it's Word Magazine number 170, where I reviewed a memoir of a New Testament scholar named Elaine Pagels. She wrote a memoir titled Why Religion? And she was a famous Gnostic scholar, still alive, but she produced a lot of literature on Gnosticism. And I pointed out when I did that review, she also talks about the ending of Mark, and she talks about how she loves the ending of Mark 16:8. Why? Because it doesn't have resurrection appearances. None of the so-called Gnostic Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, have resurrection appearances. They just have the words, the teachings, supposedly, of Jesus. And so they like this idea of a gospel that doesn't have a full passion narrative. The death, yes, Jesus dies, yeah, okay, but they don't want one that has the resurrection appearances of the Lord.
But that's another subject. But anyway, if you look at those cobbled endings, what someone has done is taken the ending of Matthew, the ending of Luke, and the ending of John, and just put them all together. Mm-hmm. And you can actually see that when you read it. It has the two men on the road to Emmaus. That's there. That's from Luke. It has the Mary Magdalene story. That's there, because that's from Matthew, and so forth. And then it even has them on the mountain in the Galilee where they get the Great Commission from Matthew.
I find this very interesting because, again, you hear the same thing from evangelical scholars who reject the traditional ending of Mark. And that one of the things they'll say is, you'll even see this in a commentary like that of William Hendrickson. They'll say, oh, what we see in verses 9 through 20 is simply cobbled together from the other gospels. And they'll mention that Mark has in Mark 16, verses 12 and 13, the mention of Christ's appearance to the two disciples. After that, verse 12 of Mark 16, he appeared in another form unto two of them as they walked and went out into the country. And they went and told it unto the residue, neither believed they them. And of course, Luke has a much longer account of this, telling us the name of one of the disciples was Cleopas, and it takes up a big part of the content of Luke chapter 24. They want us to believe that Mark simply took and abbreviated that story, and also the description of Christ's appearance to Mary Magdalene. And also, it's interesting, I think, he says in Mark that Mark 16, 15, where Mark says that Christ said to the disciples, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He says that happened in Galilee, which would be a fulfillment of what was said to the women that, as it says in verse 8, he goeth before you into Galilee. But at any rate, what's interesting about this is complete skepticism towards the unity and historicity of the Christian story. Why is it that Mark has the account of Christ appearing to the disciples as they leave Jerusalem? And why is it that Luke has it? Is it because Mark borrowed from Luke? Or is it because this really happened and is part of the authentic apostolic tradition? And Christ really did appear to Mary Magdalene. And Christ really did tell the disciples, commission the disciples to go and to preach the gospel and to baptize. See, when you're a believer and you believe in the authenticity, the unity, and the historicity of the apostolic tradition, it's not a cobbling. Mark isn't cobbling together using sources. This is source criticism, but he's simply relaying the faithful apostolic tradition in his own manner, in his own style, within his own gospel. But this is the sort of skepticism that someone like Tabor takes to be the truth, and it's merely a literary speculation that is unproven. And people like the podcast host here just seem to be there drinking it all in. Emma Thorne, she thinks she's being so sophisticated and can look down her nose snidely at ordinary Christians who believe at face value the historicity of the Gospels, but isn't she actually being naive in believing what the expert tells her without really questioning any? Does she question at all in this entire interview anything that he says? Is she really open-minded? Is she really a critical thinker when she's just drinking in everything that this scholar tells her? Let's continue.
So that's what's happening with those endings. And then the other two are even just crazier. I don't have them memorized, but it's like, and they went for it. It just says, you know, we just said it. They said nothing to anyone. Close. And then somebody puts an ending that says, and then they went forth and proclaimed the glorious gospel of Christ and salvation to the whole world. You know, new ending.
Well, I think the shorter ending and the Freer Logion are spurious, but I don't think they're necessarily crazy. I think they're spurious. They're not original. And there was never any consensus to accept them as such within early Christianity.
It definitely doesn't. So what's happened, it's Bible marketing. How are you going to sell a Bible to the evangelical world? And if you're going to do a Bible, you've got to appeal to the believing market as well as the skeptical market, not just the academic. You're not going to sell many copies. So even in the New Revised Standard or all the academic translations, they'll put a gap, and yet there'll be a note, some authorities consider this other ending to be later and derivative, not really authentic or real or original.
All right, I'll pause here for a moment. Actually, I think he makes a very interesting point here. I commend him for making this point. And what he's saying, as a scholar, I believe that Mark should end Mark 16:8. And most of my colleagues do, including my evangelical colleagues. But because publishers want to market Bibles, And they know that most people who read the buy Bibles and use Bibles and read Bibles, they will be Christians. And so we have to include the traditional ending. Otherwise, the Christian reading audience will not purchase these Bibles. But we do everything that we can to undermine the authority of these readings, even though we include them. We put a gap in there. We put notes that say this isn't in the earliest. And this is really an interesting insight. If these scholars and these Bible publishers were really bold and courageous, they would simply take Mark 16, 9 through 20 out of their published Bibles, or they would relegate it to the footnotes. And he's going to mention in just a moment, there was an effort to do that in the original Revised Standard Version. And as he's going to say, the reaction of the people in the pew was so negative that they realized that they had to reinsert it or these Bibles wouldn't sell.
Still print it. And that way it's there. And if you don't bother to look at the note, then it's okay. When the RSV first came out, and let's see, it was in, I think, 1940s and 50s.
I think the New Testament was in 1946 and the whole Bible in 1952.
People were burning the RSV because it...
Were they really? I mean, were they really burning the RSV? Maybe there were some people who were doing that. I don't know. But again, this is sort of an exaggerated, you know, story time with Dr. Tabor to show how, you know, narrow-minded those conservative Christians are.
They printed that ending in small print at the end. That's gone now. Now they put it in the regular size print.
And they do that because they want to sell Bibles to the Christian reading audience.
So that's one of the problems. But you're absolutely right to go to the ending. The beginning and ending of Mark. The last verse of Mark and the first verse of Mark are actually the key to the enigma and to the mystery.
All right, I'm going to pause there. So he says the beginning of Mark and the ending of Mark are the key to the mystery. And actually, I think what he says there is right, but for the wrong reasons. Yes, I think there is a great unity to the traditional text of Mark as it stands now. It begins Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And then if you turn to the traditional ending, it's the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And in Mark 16:15, it's go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. It begins with the gospel of Jesus Christ. It ends with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so I think there is consistency beginning to end with the traditional text and traditional translations of the Bible. The thing that stands out to me about this podcast and the reason I chose to do it was the eerie similarity between Dr. Tabor's understanding of the Gospel of Mark and Emma Thorne's drinking all this in, and the view that is expressed by most modern evangelical scholars. They basically put forward the exact same arguments. If you look at the writings of Daniel Wallace, he says Mark ended at Mark 16:8. This is a dramatic ending, and the reader has to finish the story. If you listen to James White, he will tell us, oh, Mark has multiple endings, what he said when I had a debate with him. It's got lots of endings. It's confused, and these overlook the fact that, no, there's not confusion about the ending. 99% of the extant manuscripts read the same. There's an amazing Christian consensus about the traditional ending of Mark being authentic, and it's only been since the 19th century that there have been challenges to this. Well, I hope that this little review of this YouTube video has been helpful for those who are listening, and I do hope it would reinforce in your mind and heart a trust and a confidence in not only the canonical book of Mark, but also the canonical text, the text that has been received as the authoritative text of the Gospel of Mark. Well, again, I hope this has been helpful and edifying. I'll look forward to speaking to you soon in the next episode in this podcast series. And so till we meet again, take care and may the Lord richly bless you.